Well, as the nation marches towards commemoration events for the centenary of World War I, join us each week as we take a look at what was happening in the lead up to and after the outbreak of war. A team of historians from the University of New England are taking us from the end of European peace and some of the diplomatic manoeuvring behind closed doors to what was happening on home shores. And in our 29th episode, Dr. Richard Scully takes us to one of the big battles in Africa. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Kelly.
Thanks for joining us again. Where are we picking up from today?
Well, we're picking up from last week. People might remember the defeat of the Ottoman Empire by the Russians, by the weather, at a place called Sarikamish, which is in the Caucasus, in a very distant part of Central Asia. And that's quite a nice reminder and a lead-in to this week, that the Great War really did happen in places other than in Europe.
So you're taking us off to Africa then?
We are. And Africa tends to be given pretty short shrift by historians of the Great War. But if you put it into context, at least 2 million Africans served in the armies of all the belligerent powers. They served as soldiers, as well as porters, as well as support manpower. And of those 2 million, probably more than 200,000 died or were killed in action. That number of 200,000 is actually also about the number that the French mobilised from their West African colonies. They fought in Africa as well as in Europe. And Britain sent hundreds of thousands of men from its Indian Army to Africa, as well as recruiting about 25,000 soldiers in East Africa alone, plus hundreds of thousands of labourers and porters from the rest of their colonies. And really, never before, possibly never since, really, until the Congo Wars of the 2000s, had Africa experienced a war on this scale. It had really only largely been conquered by Europeans very recently, as far as the World War was concerned, from the mid-1880s through to the 1900s. And for those of you interested in pub trivia, the fact that the Great War in Africa actually lasted longer than the Great War elsewhere. The first shots, from a British soldier at least, were probably fired from the gun of Regimental Sergeant Major Alhaji Gurshini of the Gold Coast Regiment, which happened on August the 7th, 1914, so very early for Britain. And it wasn't until the 25th of November, 1918, that the war there actually ended, when the German commander in Africa, Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck, marched his men out of the bush to surrender to the British in northern Rhodesia. So if you do your maths, that's about 2 weeks after the armistice of the 11th of the 11th. Mm-hmm. And what's even stranger is that Lettow, when he got back to Berlin, was given something like a victory parade. One of Germany's greatest military heroes, he was really the only one who was undefeated out of the First World War.
Jeez. So how was Africa caught up in the theatre that was this the war as it started?
Well, if you think about Africans, as I say, having very recently been conquered by Europeans at the beginning of the 20th century, Africans were basically caught up in a war that was someone else's war. It was forced on them by their colonial masters. They were supposedly the beneficiaries of European civilization, but during the war they were treated pretty terribly. If you think back to a time when, you know, pseudoscience of the day recognized that apparently there were these races of people and there were superior and inferior races, it wasn't that long ago that people actually believed this. Most Africans who served died of disease or exhaustion. They were often worked to death. If you think about an average African porter in this period carrying about 60 pounds, so what, 27 kilograms of material on treks through very, very rough terrain, up to 24 k's a day, up and down mountains through jungles, across swamps, etc., and given only really minimum rations, it's not surprising that they suffered so badly. Those Africans that the French took out of their home continent and brought to Europe to fight, they had never experienced European winters before, so they actually suffered terribly in the European context. Although the French tended to treat them a little better than, say, the British did. So it's very hard for us to make that conceptual leap to understand what it was actually like for Africans during the First World War. We mentioned in October last year in this series that there was a pro-German rebellion in South Africa, but today is probably the first time we get to focus on something quintessentially African, the Battle of Yassini, or Yassin, that happened in German East Africa, which is now called Tanzania. And it took place 100 years ago at the end of this week, the 18th and 19th of January 1915. They're very isolated aspects of the war in Africa, but it's a good place to start, I think.
Yeah, so Richard, Africa had been carved up, though, by all these other sort of countries. What was happening to the continent?
Well, yeah, if you think about the period from the 1880s through to the 1900s, the very time that Australia is becoming a nation, well, this is the time when Africa is being destroyed as sort of a group of nations. The scramble for Africa, most of West Africa and the Sahara, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, etc., through into the central part of the continent, was basically painted blue across this period by France, as France swallowed up about 37% of the whole continent and about a quarter of its population in just a few years. The British worked north from South Africa, and they worked south from Egypt. They sort of tried to meet in the middle, as well as inland from Gambia and Sierra Leone, Ghana and Nigeria. They basically took up about 24% of the continent, painting it the imperial red and absorbing probably about 40% of its population. And France also took that huge island of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean, that the movies are made about, and they shared some strategic territory with Britain near Ethiopia, and the rest of the continent gets carved up too by Spain, for instance, Portugal inland from Angola and Mozambique, Italy and Libya and the Horn of Africa, and perhaps one of the most bizarre colonial empires you've ever heard of, the little Belgian empire in the vast Congo Basin, which later became Zaire and is now the Democratic Republic of Congo. It wasn't an easy process, despite the fact that I'm describing it happening in just sort of overnight and being painted quite nicely on the maps. The British, of course, had to fight in South Africa between 1899 and 1902 in the Boer War. The Italians were kicked very unceremoniously out of Ethiopia in 1896. But by 1914, when the war starts, only Ethiopia and the small country of Liberia, a freed slave colony, were independent of European control. And people who are familiar with the map of Africa today, the boundaries that you see there are very close to the ones that existed at the beginning of the First World War, when the Europeans were still ruling the place. Those lines, they're often very straight, very strange-looking things. They took very little notice of any local national boundaries, tribal spheres of influence, natural features. There's a really bizarre line that separates Kenya from Tanzania, for instance, that only really exists today the way it does, because Britain and Germany had agreed that, well, Germany will get Mount Kilimanjaro, but at the time nobody knew where it was. So they had to draw this line on the map and then redraw it later on.
What were the Germans up to, Richard?
Well, they were very late comers to imperial expansion. This is probably one of the reasons why the First World War happened, actually. And the German Empire had managed to snap up a few colonies, very limited commercial value at the time, the Cameroons, Togoland, Southwest Africa, which is called Namibia today, very desert area. The only really valuable German colonial possession in the beginning of the 20th century was East Africa, which is today called Tanzania. And German East Africa was particularly galling for a lot of British patriots, Australians included, because this area of German territory really did prevent that old-fashioned dreamed of Cape to Cairo route that the British had been proposing since Cecil Rhodes in the 19th century. So it was therefore a colony that was quite valuable, and that the British in particular had their relatively greedy eyes on from way back, to be taken at the first opportunity.
So what was happening then as the Germans became more involved?
Well, it's easy, I think, to imagine this is a continent of European domination. The Germans certainly did dominate the territories that they took, but Europeans and African elites in particular tended to cooperate a little bit. So it was Africans, if you like, cooperating in their own conquest, junior partners in the business of empire, for instance. And so by the time 1914 comes around, a lot of Africans actually feel a bit of an investment in European empire themselves. A lot of them joined up, actually, to fight for their king and country. That's how they thought of King George, for instance, or their Kaiser and fatherland, for many of the same reasons that Australians did. Seeking adventure, chance to prove that they're real men, prestige, just escape from the drudgery and hardship of everyday life.
So what's happening by 1914?
Well, it's a big opportunity for a lot of Africans. Europeans, of course, want to redraw the map. Africans want to make something of this conflict for themselves. And 1914, in strategic terms, Britain and France managed to snap up a lot of the German colonies pretty quickly. Germany has a big navy, but it's confined to Europe. It can't protect its empire. And German East Africa, actually, is an exception to the rule. It was a pretty tough nut to crack. The Germans only had about 260 European troops there, and they were organised in a thing called a Schutztruppe, a defence troop. But in addition, they had about 2,500 Askaris, which were German-trained and equipped, but they were native Africans. And these, pretty small numbers when you think about it, when you think about how many Australians went to fight in the war, they were able to balance against a roughly the same amount of British troops in Kenya to the north. But once war is declared, of course, strategic terms, the British can bring in as many reinforcements as they like. But the Germans, although they've got some local naval power, they would have to rely on what they had. And so you get this situation where the British, they're very overconfident. They send in about 12,000 British Indian troops in November of 1914 in two columns, marching from the south from British Rhodesia, is about 4,000 men, about 8,000 land amphibiously, in an interesting sort of echo of Gallipoli that's going to happen in a few months. They land at Tanga on November the 2nd of 1914, and realistically you can see some of the mistakes that the British then make in Gallipoli later on at Tanga. The Germans are outnumbered 8-1 in the south by 4-1 at Tanga, but the British fail dismally. They have very heavy casualties. The Germans can drive them back into the sea. So it's a massive boost for German morale. The British don't learn their lessons. The Germans hold the line, and in fact they then manage to attack the British from a position of relative weakness.
And that now takes us to this week, this particular battle, does it?
That's right, the Battle of Jassen, or Jassini, 100 years ago this week. I mentioned the German commander earlier, Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck, a very interesting man. He took his 250 Schutztruppen and about 1,300 of his askaris. He had only about 23 machine guns and four artillery pieces, but he went to recapture this town called Jassen, or Jassini, which had been occupied by only about 300 British and Indian troops, and they occupied it on Christmas Day of 1914. And by this stage, after the Battle of Tanga, they're pretty demoralised. Not only that, but they're also in very much better contact about the war in Europe. They know how badly things are going there as well. Plus, they're really only there to guard against any local tribes rising up in support of the Germans. So when the Germans arrive, things don't look good for the Allied forces there, but they did put up a pretty good fight. They held on to Jassen for probably more than a day, but the costs began to mount pretty terribly. 86 British and Indians are killed, 200 wounded by the time the two commanders, Captains Hansen and Turner, surrender to Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck on January the 19th. And the Germans' losses are also pretty heavy. 13 out of the 22 regular German army officers are wounded, 23 Schutztruppen are killed, and in addition there's an unknown casualty rate for the askaris, which must have been in the hundreds, probably.
It doesn't sort of sound like the same numbers we've been hearing out of Europe, though, in the last couple of weeks of casualties.
No, that's absolutely right. Around about the same time in Europe, the First Battle of Champagne, the French and the British are losing 96,000 men to the Germans, 46,000 men killed and wounded. So the numbers in Africa, hundreds, maybe thousands, mobilised, anywhere between 100 or even 20 or 30 wounded or killed. They don't sound like great war battles. Jassen also only went for about 2 days, whereas in Europe, the Battle of Champagne dragged on for months. So it gives you an interesting sort of problem to sort of think about. It sounds a bit gruesome to compare, well, who really cares about a couple of hundred people as against the thousands in Europe, but it's a very, very good reminder, I think. And we as Australians probably understand this a little better than some people, I think, that we have to pull ourselves up from time to time. When you see numbers on the page, 96,000, or even just 25, they're still individual human lives. They're not just statistics. For every man killed or wounded, there's a family behind him, to say nothing of the value of an individual human life. And that's the same in Africa as it is in Europe. It doesn't matter where you are. Plus, if you want to look at the big picture, Jassen is actually a battle which is, although it's very small comparatively, had far-reaching strategic consequences for the rest of the war.
Why is that?
Well, I mentioned the Germans could expect very few reinforcements and supply drops. Heck, later in the war, they even tried to send a Zeppelin down south to drop as much as they could and then get back. The British could expect a great deal. So it was at Jassen that the German commander, Lettow, realises he's never going to be able to fight the old-fashioned way. He's not going to be able to fight a war of attrition. His troops have expended 200,000 rounds of ammunition during this one battle. And even though he's captured a lot of rifles and British ammunition, he's never going to be able to continue that that war of attrition. So he decides, therefore, to adopt a completely different style of warfare. And he abandons the old fixed line, frontal battle sort of thing, lines of defence, and he launches a guerrilla warfare style campaign. And he and his men, they melt into the bush, into the jungles of East Africa, and they engage the British in hit-and-run raids against railways, supply depots, small groups of men, etc. He's able, therefore, with only a very few thousand men, to tie down tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of British and Allied troops. And he would only ever concentrate his troops when he knew there was going to be a good chance of victory.
Had the British ever come across that kind of warfare before?
They had in their colonies before. In South Africa, for instance, they had a great deal of trouble, sort of fighting this kind of warfare. And they had the same sort of problem in German East Africa. Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck, as I mentioned, was able to fight on in this very way until 2 weeks after the end of war in Europe. And he surrendered then because he knew that the empire had fallen on the 25th of November 1918. And so during his 4.5 years as commander, he's probably the most successful commander in the entire conflict. He manages to threaten British Kenya, Uganda, the Belgian Congo, Rhodesia, Portuguese Mozambique. If you think about that in geographic terms, that is a vast area of the world. That's probably more than 10% of the African continent. He manages to beat British, French, Belgian, Indian, South African forces. It's really quite remarkable. And moreover, if you think about this as, again, an exception from the rest of the Great War, this is a man who is a nobleman. He's a man of the old school, and he's able to continue an older style of warfare in many ways. When those two British commanders at Yassin surrender, they come to see Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck, and he says, well, congratulations, you've done so well. Sit down, have a cup of tea, etc. He then releases these two men and says, well, you know, on the expectation, a gentleman's agreement, shake hands, that you won't be fighting in the war anymore. Basically, you've been bested, and now I'll release you on that proviso, a little bit like some sort of old chivalric kind of
gentleman's agreement.
Yeah, yeah. Of course they renege, and Leto, of course, he wasn't a wonderful person. He could be pretty brutal, but the conduct of the war in East Africa, in that sense, makes something of a decided sort of a nice change. In fact, from many of the hatreds that get engendered by the rest of the conflict.
Richard, what's the sort of legacy of this conflict for the African people?
It's continued colonialism, of course, and probably a more brutal form of colonialism, but there is a very nice little postscript to all of this, and that relates to the Askaris, who are these loyal and extremely honourable Africans who served the Kaiser and the Fatherland so well during the Great War. After the war, there's a new German Republic. They agree that they're going to pay veterans' pensions to these men, to their former colonial subjects. But this, of course, gets interrupted by World War II, by the Cold War, etc. But 50 years later, in 1964, the new West German Parliament decides that they should revisit this scheme. They feel a moral obligation to it in an era of anti-colonialism. And so they decide to conduct a survey. They find there's around about 350 of these Askaris from the Great War who are still alive. And what makes it perhaps easier for them bureaucratically is some of them even had their commissioning papers from the First World War still lying around. Some of them still had certificates of service that were given out by Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck at the end of the war. But those of them who don't have that sort of proof, they're in a bit of a tricky situation. Some of them manage to bring out some old uniforms and show them to these German visitors and say, well, here's proof. But in the end, the best way that is found to actually demonstrate that some of these old men, after 50 years, they're not lying, that they were involved in Imperial Germany's war, is a German visitor, commander, officer, hands these men a broomstick in imitation of a rifle. And without fail, every single one of them is able to perform the old German drill, the old presentation of arms, exactly as it was under the old imperial system, without having forgotten anything, because it was so well drilled into them and they were such good soldiers during the Great War that they can prove that fact to a bureaucrat 50 years later.
How extraordinary that that's what they were using.
That's right. And, of course, they all got their pensions as a result.